Come on. Any dad who gets his little girl a pink phone can't be all bad. She followed Gus into a kitchen that rivaled those dream spreads in magazines. Solid cherrywood cabinets, lots of granite and stainless steel, an island the size of Hawaii. Andy pulled up a stool at the counter. Gus remained standing, too nervous to sit. A beam of welcome sunlight streamed down through the skylight, almost drawing a line between them. You haven't told Morgan the FBI's looking for her mother, have you? It was a question, but her tone was judgmental. Not specifically. I was afraid the mere mention of something like the FBI would only make it more scary to her. You need to be honest. Kids are more intuitive than you think. Especially this one. If she's this self-aware at 6, I'm dreading 16. A little extra maturity isn't at all unusual in an only child. Gus poured 2 coffees, then came to the opposite side of the counter. Morgan certainly has some adult-sized proclivities, he said, thinking of the little wooden horse that had disappeared from his office. How do you mean? Nothing. Have you given any more thought to what I told you about Beth? For the past hour, that's all I've thought about. And? The eating disorder, the shoplifting? I'd say they're related manifestations of the same problem. Lack of self-esteem, purpose, identity. Sounds like a troubled woman crying out for help. I've heard of eating disorders, even self-mutilation, but shoplifting? Andy sipped her coffee, then glanced at the surroundings. She lived in a world where no material need went unfilled. Stealing a basic necessity like clothing was the ultimate way for her to break from what she was. Has she ever done anything like that before? Stealing? No. Has she ever shown any resentment for the kind of life you've given her? Not that I know of. You have any idea why she would be so unhappy with what she was? That's a more complicated question. Let me try to simplify it. Your wife did accuse you of spouse abuse some years ago. Yes, she did. Abuse has a way of making a woman do strange things, especially if it occurs over many years. I've seen more than one abused wife snap and do some pretty strange things. Beth was not an abused wife. She softened her tone, not looking for a confrontation. Can we talk a little about that? You said the same thing the night we met at the medical examiner's office. I'd like to believe you, but why did she file that report? Like I said, it's complicated. She wondered if complicated meant Martha Goldstein. I think it's important for me to know, don't you? He wasn't eager to reopen those wounds, but it was undeniably relevant. After Morgan was born, Beth had terrible postpartum depression. Didn't come out of the bedroom for days at a time. Didn't want anything to do with Morgan. That's more common than you would think. He stirred a little sugar into his coffee. That's what I'm told, but that didn't make it any easier. We needed double shift nannies to take care of the baby, because Beth wasn't even taking care of herself. I tried to get her to see a psychiatrist, but she wouldn't go. It got to be a daily routine. I'd come home, she'd still be in bed where I left her. We started having arguments. Just the exchange of words, nothing else. She'd cry and yell at me, saying I ignored her, I neglected her. It seemed like we were having the same argument night after night. Except after a while, she started using the word abuse. Things hadn't changed. If I was doing anything wrong, I was still busy at work, ignoring her, as she said. But suddenly she was calling it abuse. So you're saying that's the full extent of the abuse? That's exactly what I'm saying. It's not what you'd infer from the police report she filed. She claimed you physically hit her. That was pure embellishment. Why would she make that up? Why would she steal a size 12 dress from a department store? Is that what you're hoping? That people will hear she was shoplifting and finally believe she made up the abuse allegations? Gus looked stunned, then angered. I have no intention of making this public. I'm telling you this only because I hope it will help you find out what happened to Beth. I called you in confidence. Sorry. It's just that you're a very prominent attorney in this town. Kind of hard to believe you don't care what other people think. I did care. It bothered me a great deal the way people reacted back then. My friends, her friends, my own law firm. I almost lost my job over it. Somehow a mere accusation was enough to convict me, even after Beth retracted it. It's hard for outsiders to know what to believe in those situations. Then why do they always want to believe the worst? It's juicy, I guess. A high-powered lawyer who abused his wife. Or a desperate wife who makes the whole thing up to keep him from leaving her for another woman. Where did you hear that? I can't say. You talked to Martha Goldstein, didn't you? I really can't talk about that. That's her angle. She plants ideas in your head so she can honestly tell my partners and my clients that I'm under police investigation. It's all a ploy. She's using you. I don't know anything about that. I know it's Martha. She somehow fancied herself the other woman. Rumors like that only made it harder for Beth and me to patch things up and move forward. It is hard, even if you love each other. And I did love Beth. But not enough to change. He stared into his coffee cup. We just seemed to drift further apart. Over the Martha rumors? No. The real difficulty was me. I never fully believed she made up the charges to get my attention or keep me from leaving her. When she filed that report, it was as if part of her were wishing I had crossed the line. I'm not saying she wanted to be abused, but I do think she wished the issues had been more black and white. It sounds crazy, but the real problem was that we had something really good a long time ago. I suppose she needed something really bad to make her finally give up on that. You know what I mean? His question hit close to her own personal disaster, her own recent pain at the altar. I suppose decisions are easier when somebody does something horrendous. Like me and my ex-fiance. Bam, I was out of there. No hesitation. What happened? Not important. It was so unlike your situation with Beth. But you do understand. I understand what you're saying. But if you really loved her, I can't say I understand how you let it get to that point. He fell silent, absorbing the blow. Neither can I. Daddy! Morgan was sprinting up the hall. Gus turned and braced himself. She nearly ran him over.
Daddy, you missed it! You missed it!
She spoke in short, panicky breaths, her voice shaking.
Missed what? I can't believe you missed it.
Tears filled her eyes. Gus lifted her up and sat her on the counter.
Missed what? Just now.
Morgan, calm down. What's wrong?
While you were talking, you just missed it.
Missed what? She shouted with all her breath.
Mommy called.
He froze for an instant, then raced down the hall. Chapter 28. In seconds, Gus was in his daughter's bedroom. Andy and Morgan were right behind. He snatched up the phone from the pink rug beside the bed where Morgan had dropped it. The dial tone hummed in his ear.
"Does Morgan's line have caller ID?" asked Andy. She was standing in the doorway.
"No."
"Hit star 69, then."
Gus had used the memory call service before. It automatically dialed the number of the last incoming phone call. He punched the buttons and waited. A young girl answered.
"Hello?"
"Who is this?"
"Hannah."
Confused, Gus covered the mouthpiece and asked his daughter,
"Did your friend Hannah call you this morning?"
Morgan nodded slowly. Gus returned to the phone. "I'm sorry, Hannah. This is Morgan Wheatley's father. We dialed the wrong number." He hung up and gave Morgan a stern look.
"I thought you said your mother called."
"She did."
He appealed to Andy, not sure what to do. Andy sat on the edge of the bed at eye level with the 6-year-old.
"Are you sure it was your mom who called?"
Yes, it was her. It had to be her.
This is very important. If she called, your daddy and I want to talk to her.
She called. I know it was her.
Gus took her hand gently. What did she say, sweetie?
She didn't say anything.
The adult shared a moment of skepticism. You never heard her voice? Asked Gus.
No.
Then how do you know it was Mommy who called?
The numbers.
I don't understand. What numbers?
9534889.
Andy asked, is that Beth's cell phone number? No. Sweetheart, what are you talking about? Morgan picked up the phone and put it to her father's ear.
Listen.
She punched out the numbers. It made a tune. Gus looked at Andy. Mary had a little lamb. Morgan said,
that's what I'm telling you. Mommy showed me how to do that long time ago. She called me and hit the numbers, just now, and then she hung up.
Gus felt a chill. Did you ever tell Hannah about those numbers? Did she know how to play that tune, too?
No way. That was me and Mommy's secret.
He looked quizzically at Andy. Why did I get Hannah when I dialed memory call? People can buy devices to beat any of those phone company services. Memory call, caller ID. We see it all the time with creeps who make obscene calls. So, it could have been made from a telephone that was outfitted with one of those electronic gizmos? That would explain how you got Hannah when you dialed star 69. You would have pulled up the second-to-last call rather than the last call. Then it's possible it was Beth.
It was, Mommy. I know it was.
Morgan was so frustrated she was about to hit him. Gus was silent, but he sensed Andy had the same exact thought. She sprang from the bed. I'll get one of our technical agents to see if he can track the call. He tossed her the phone. Let's not use Morgan's anymore. I don't want to screw anything up. The kitchen, said Gus, leading the way. He spoke as they hurried down the hall. If it was Beth who called, why didn't she talk? I can't answer that. They stopped at the kitchen counter. Fear was in his eyes. You don't think this was some kind of prank? That's what I hope my techies can tell me. But if it wasn't a prank, why the numbers? I don't know. Maybe your daughter can help us with that. I don't think so. It's more a matter of thinking it through logically. A woman disappears for nearly a week. She's finally able to get to a phone. She's able to dial the numbers, but she doesn't speak. There are only a couple of possibilities. Either she doesn't want to speak, or she can't. The words chilled him. Can't speak? Meaning what? Their eyes met and held. It was as if she were telling him there were any number of possibilities, none of them pretty. Let's get the technical agents on the trail, all right? Then we can brainstorm. Gus nodded, then swallowed the lump in his throat. Okay, he said quietly as she dialed the number. Andy was on the phone with technical agents when Carla rang the doorbell. In all the confusion, Gus had almost forgotten he'd called his sister before Andy's arrival. He wanted her there to watch Morgan, just in case the FBI visit ended up taking all morning or required him to leave the house. Good thing he'd called, though he certainly hadn't anticipated this. The house seemed chaotic, considering it was just the four of them. Andy was in the kitchen, actually speaking on two phones at once, her cellular and the Wheatley's. Morgan was continually bopping between her room and Gus's home office, the two free lines. She was sure that staring at the phone would make it ring again, but she couldn't decide which one to watch. Gus trailed after her, letting her burn off the excitement. He gave Carla all the details as they traced the erratic steps of the 6-year-old across the house. Carla asked, "You sure Morgan isn't making this up?" They were standing outside Morgan's bedroom, the door open, keeping an eye on her inside. After those shoplifting allegations panned out, I don't have much room to doubt her word anymore. Morgan hurried past them, then down the hall, back to Gus's office. Gus and Carla followed at a safe distance behind so that Morgan couldn't overhear. Doesn't it scare you that she didn't speak? Of course it does, said Gus. I mean, that she would have said something. if she could have. That's sort of where Agent Henning and I came out.
So, why couldn't she?
They stopped near Gus's office, just off the kitchen. He glanced across the room at Andy on the phone, then looked down, unable to look Carla in the eye. I have this image in my head.
Image?
I keep seeing Beth on the floor, her hands and feet tied, crawling to a phone. She knocks it off the hook. Her mouth is gagged. She can't talk. So she pecks out this tune on the keypad.
That's brilliant,
she said, impressed. He shot a look. It's horrifying. A yelp of excitement drew their attention to the kitchen. Andy hung up the phone and hissed out loud, "Yes!" like a tennis pro who just served an ace. She shouted, "We pegged the call!" Gus hurried into the kitchen.
"Where?"
"It came from Oregon. A payphone just across the state line."
A payphone?
So much for his image of Beth crawling on the floor.
"Yeah, they're on their way to check it out."
She pulled on her overcoat and grabbed her car keys.
"I'm headed there myself."
"I'm going with you," said Gus.
"You can't. What if another call comes?"
He agonized for a moment, but realized she was right.
"What if another one does come? What do I do?"
"We've set up a trap and trace on all three house lines now. If a remotely suspicious call comes on any one of them, keep it going as long as you can." Gus led her to the foyer and opened the front door.
"Call me the minute you hear anything."
"I will, but Gus, please, try not to drive yourself crazy with worry." He watched from the top step as she turned and hurried to her car. "Too late," he thought as her car sped away. "I'm way beyond worried." Chapter 29. Andy drove alone to the northernmost nub of western Oregon. In these parts, the irregular path of the Columbia River defined the state line, which accounted for the little pocket of Oregon that protruded into southwestern Washington. Her exact destination was near the city of Rainier, 40 miles north of Portland on the Oregon side of the river. Most of the trip was interstate at high speed. She played no radio, no books on cassette. She was alone with her thoughts, mostly about Beth Wheatley. Her mind did wander somewhat. Exit signs for connections to Route 101 reminded her of the trip she and Rick had taken along the coast, Washington to San Francisco, the long and scenic route. She had hoped it would be romantic, but Rick kept brooding over the fact that she had vetoed his preference for nude beaches in Jamaica. In hindsight, she should have seen the early warning signs of a guy who wanted to put his girlfriend on display, as if to show the rest of the world what he was getting. So intent was he on going that it took a threat to settle the matter. She vowed to dissolve copious quantities of Viagra, the miracle cure for impotence, into his piña coladas. Rick backed off immediately. Nothing was more uncool than a cheesy grin tourist on a nude beach with a permanent erection. The gray fog thickened as she crossed the bridge over the Columbia River, a far cry from sunny Jamaican beaches. Rain fell, then stopped, then started again as she drove through Rainier to a more remote area outside town. According to her technical agents, the call to Morgan's line had come from a payphone along the highway, a public rest area, to be exact, just west of Rainier, and situated at the foot of a forested preserve. She hadn't mentioned anything to Gus, but a payphone was the last place she had expected the trace to have led them. With three dead women who looked so much like her, the thought of Beth Wheatley at a payphone punching out Mary Had a Little Lamb just didn't add up. Unless, by some miracle, she had escaped. Rain gathered on the windshield, and the image in her mind was suddenly vivid. A desperate woman leaping from her captor's van as it rounded the corner, the rough pavement ripping at her flesh as she rolled into the parking lot. The mad dash to the payphone, her attacker in pursuit. Her hands shaking as she frantically punched the buttons. The excitement of the call going through. The frustration of finding she couldn't respond to her own daughter's voice, couldn't speak at all. A gag, possibly, or a rope around her neck. Her attacker grabbing her, pulling her back toward the van, but she hangs on long enough to bang out a tune her daughter would recognize. Andy shook off the disturbing image and turned into the rest area. It was a typical-looking highway road stop, a flat roof perched on brown-painted cinder blocks. A bank of three payphones was in the middle, flanked by men's and women's facilities to the left and right, respectively. The entire building, parking lot, and neighboring curtilage had been marked off as a crime scene with yellow police tape. A forensic team was already at work. Two men were casting a mold for a tire track near a puddle. Another was scouring the payphone for fingerprints. Four teams had fanned out in all directions, searching the surrounding area for articles of clothing, footprints, blood, weapons, anything of interest. Andy parked near a squad car on the opposite side of the highway. She stepped out, shocked for a moment by the cold wind. The tall stand of pines behind the building blocked any view of the river, though it was near enough to feel its damp chill. Andy cinched up her trench coat, crossed the highway, and started toward the shelter. A deputy sheriff stopped her before she could duck under the tape. She identified herself and flashed her credentials. He was expecting her. "This way," he said, then led her around the back the long way, outside the yellow-taped perimeter. The wind was blowing harder. Her nose started to run. She stayed a half-step behind him so he wouldn't notice. "Anybody see anything?" she asked, still walking. "We got the word out to local news asking people to come forward if they were near the rest area this morning, but it wouldn't get your hopes up." They stopped at a ridge about 50 meters behind the rest area. The stand of pines was behind them. A steep cliff was at their feet. Thick gray clouds moved slowly through the valley like the ghost of a glacier. The deputy offered his binoculars and pointed to an area deep in the valley. "Down there, through that clearing." With a naked eye, she noticed a team converging near the bank of a winding stream. She trained the binoculars toward a wooded area that had shed its leaves for winter. She peered intently, though by now it was a scene she could have described without looking. Through the tangle of branches, the ravaged body of yet another nude brunette hung limply from a tree. For Gus, the minutes passed like hours. Andy had been gone for more than 2 hours, and he had yet to hear anything. It was a long drive to Rainier, he knew, but he had hoped for more frequent updates. Finally, the phone rang. Gus started in his chair, but didn't answer. It rang again. Carla snapped, "Answer it!" He was frozen for a moment by the possibility of bad news. He grabbed it on the third ring. "We found a body," said Andy. "Oh, my God!" "It's okay. It's not Beth." Gus was relieved at first, then felt guilty about it. True, it wasn't Beth, but it was someone. Carla was nearly draped over him, concerned. "Did they find her?" he asked. He covered the mouthpiece, quickly told her what he knew, then continued with Andy. "Who is it?" "We don't know yet. Identification might take time. Another one exposed to the elements." "Let me guess. She looks like Beth." "Not quite as much as the others, but yes. In a general way, there's a resemblance." "Do you know anything about her?" "Really nothing as yet." His head was pounding. "I guess there are a couple of things we'll never know."
"What's that?"
"Whether she has Morgan's number, and whether she knows how to play Mary Had a Little Lamb on the phone." There was silence on the line, as if Andy didn't know what to say.
"I gotta go, Gus. I'll keep you informed."
"Thanks." He hung up and looked straight at Carla. She asked anxiously,
"What's going on? Is Beth okay?"
"They sure as hell don't know." He looked away, focused on nothing, really, but his gaze intensified. "And I'll be damned if I'm gonna wait around for them to find out."
Chapter 30.
Late Monday afternoon, Andy drove to the airport Hilton to meet with Victoria Santos and Isaac Underwood. It wasn't a scheduled meeting, but Victoria diverted from her case in Sacramento for a much-needed brainstorming session. Isaac brought Alex Gould with him, a retired special agent who had served as profile coordinator for the Seattle field office. Gould was trained at the FBI Academy and had done some impressive work in his day. But for his personality, he might well have been selected to join the profilers in Quantico. The unit was too small and too elite to reward another insufferable know-it-all, however talented. It was an unusual move, dusting off a retired agent. That made Andy a little nervous. She wondered if Isaac still deemed her up to the task. To his credit, he made a point of pulling her aside before the meeting to reassure her. "Just wanted another perspective on this, Andy. Don't get paranoid on me." She wanted to accept that, but it wasn't just Gould who had her nervous. It seemed strange that Isaac would personally attend a meeting like this, a little too hands-on for the office ASAC. Perhaps he was trying to show Victoria how important this case was to the office. Perhaps he wanted to evaluate the performance of his former protege firsthand. Either way, Andy felt under the microscope. For Victoria's convenience, they met in a hotel suite right at the airport. An occasional commercial jet streaked across the sky outside their seventh-floor window, but not even the space shuttle would have broken their concentration. Victoria sat in an armchair near the television. Isaac sat across from her, preferring the desktop itself to the chair behind it. Andy was seated on the couch with Gould. They were at opposite ends, but Gould was such a large man, they were still closer than Andy would have liked. For a man who had joined the FBI in the height of the image-conscious Hoover era, he had certainly let himself go in retirement. Andy updated them on the latest victim outside Rainier. The group listened and fished little goldfish crackers from a bowl on the coffee table, the bulk going to Gould. When she had finished, Isaac took over. "The basic question is, why would the killer lead us to the recovery site with this strange phone call to a six-year-old?" "Let's take a broader look," said Victoria. "We have two contacts. The latest one is to Morgan Wheatley, but the first was to the Torture Victims Institute." She glanced at Andy. "How is your follow-up in Minneapolis coming?"
"It's pretty much done." "Excuse me," said Gould. He brushed the gold layer of cracker crumbs from his bulging lap onto Andy, as if she were a dustpan. "I went over the whole file just this morning, and I didn't see anything to suggest it's pretty much done."
"Maybe you missed it." She brushed the crumbs back at him.
"Maybe it isn't pretty much done."
She glanced at Isaac as if to say, "You invited this jerk?" "Mr. Gould, I assure you I've worked very hard on this case."
"I'm sure you've done your best."
"What is that supposed to mean?" Isaac interjected. "Andy, what's happening in Minnesota?" She let it go. "The Minneapolis office put two agents on it. They reviewed records, interviewed current staff. To the extent possible, they interviewed former staff and even some former patients. They focused especially on people who were fired or disciplined. Anyone who showed any bitterness toward the Institute, any individuals or organizations that opposed the type of work that was going on there. They've also done follow-ups with certain victims to determine whether any of their torturers might currently be in the United States." "Any leads?"
"Nothing promising."
Isaac said, "We have to look at everyone who was ever an employee of the Institute. Not just the ones who were fired. Check everyone." "We did," said Andy, "but I'll double-check." Victoria asked, "What about the International Center for Victims of Torture in Denmark? Have they received any messages that might be from our killer?"
"None they've identified."
"You've actually checked, then," said Gould.
"Yes," said Andy. "I checked. There's nothing." Gould rose and started to pace, his look pensive. He moistened his finger and gathered the last few specks from the cracker bowl.
"That may tell us something in and of itself."
"Like what?" asked Isaac.
"From what I saw on the file, Miss Henning's initial theory was that his email to the National Institute in Minnesota was simply his way of telling us that his signature is torture."
"That was actually my theory," said Victoria. Gould said,
"That's quite all right. We all make mistakes, Vicky."
"It's Victoria. And where's the mistake?"
Gould was still pacing, stroking his double chin.
"Think about it. If our killer was simply trying to convey the message that torture is what gets him off, why would he limit his email message to the Torture Institute in Minnesota? Why not the International Center in Denmark? It's every bit as accessible on the Internet. It seems more likely that he has a connection of some sort to the National Institute. All the more reason to turn up the scrutiny there. Isaac said, maybe he just doesn't know about the International Center. That's possible, too, said Gould. In fact, that fits neatly with my own preliminary take on this guy. He's got no time to do any homework. He's too rushed. That's what I see here. A guy in a hurry. He's showing signs of a spree killer, like that young fellow who killed Gianni Versace.
Cunanan?
Right, Andrew Cunanan. Someone who's killing people in rapid succession, no cooling off period. Usually these types are at the end of their run when they kill this rapidly. They know they're going to be caught. They want as big a splash as possible when they check out.
It's a fine line, said Victoria. Spree versus serial. Serial killers often have shorter cooling off periods toward the end of their run, too. Let's not get hung up on labels, said Isaac. It's not just semantics, said Victoria. It's a whole different psychological profile. If we have a serial killer, even one at the end of his run, we're still talking about a psychopathic sexual sadist. That's what serial killers are, and that's what I see here. As much as Hollywood likes to cast them as clever geniuses who enjoy a deadly game of cat and mouse with law enforcement, the truth is they kill because they're driven by uncontrollable sexual fantasies and a warped sense of values that makes their own 10-second orgasm more important than the life of the average 35-year-old woman. A spree killer is different. Who the hell knows what drove Andrew Cunanan to kill Gianni Versace? Spree, serial, whatever, said Isaac. Let's get back to my original question. What's the point of phoning Morgan Wheatley and dialing Mary Had a Little Lamb?
Gould said, with all due respect for Agent Santos, I believe this phone call is indeed the game of a spree killer who's looking for a showdown. He's dropping little breadcrumbs as clues along the way, luring us closer, bringing this thing to a head.
I disagree, said Andy.
Gould smirked. Oh, that takes courage, jumping on the Santos bandwagon.
I'm just thinking logically. If the killer wanted to taunt us with clues on how to find him, he could have simply picked up the phone and called us himself.
I didn't say he was trying to make it easy for us, said Gould. He knows that Mr. Wheatley has been dealing with the FBI, and he assumed the phone lines in his house were being monitored. Maybe he feared voice identification.
Isaac said, he could have let Beth speak.
Too risky, said Gould. She could have talked too long and sure to trace.
We got a trace anyway, said Isaac. Which is exactly what the killer wanted, said Andy.
Gould scoffed. What? Now you're on Isaac's bandwagon? You're all over the map, Henning.
I'm not on anybody's bandwagon, you blowhard. He backed off, indignant.
Hey, I'm here as a favor. I don't need your grief.
The room was silent. Andy said, I'm sorry. I admit I don't have the experience of the rest of you, but I've thought about this case more than anyone on the planet, with the possible exception of Gus Wheatley. I feel like I have something important to say about it. Then say it, Andy. As I see it, this breaks down to two questions. First, why did he call from that payphone? The answer, he wanted us to find the body. Why would he want that? If you look at the pattern on the map, these recovery sites keep moving south. Seattle, Issaquah, now Oregon. Maybe he's just trying to point us in the wrong direction. Victoria nodded, which energized her. Andy continued. Which leads to the second question. Why didn't he just dump the body on the highway where somebody would quickly find it? Or if he felt the need to use the phone, why didn't he just call 911 or the newspaper and tell them where the body was? Why did he call Morgan Wheatley and play a tune on her phone? There's only one explanation I can come up with. He wants us to know he has Beth Wheatley. Really has her. Isaac asked, you mean sexually? I'm talking beyond the realm of the physical. He wants us to know he's been inside her head, knows everything about her, right down to the secret code she uses to communicate with her daughter. He wants us to know he controls her. They exchanged glances in silence. No one challenged her. It made sense. Andy continued, "This isn't a spree killer looking for some suicidal showdown on the evening news. He's a serial killer asserting his control. He doesn't want us to catch him. To the contrary, he doesn't think we can." The silence turned uneasy. It was the familiar fear that lurked in the mind whenever a killer fancied himself uncatchable. He might be right. "The question is," said Victoria, "does he still control her?"
"Meaning?" asked Gould.
"Meaning, is it purely the memory of Beth Wheatley that fuels this psychopath's fantasy? Or," said Andy, "is he keeping her alive?" A sudden chill swept over them, as if no one were quite certain which would be worse.
This ends Disc 5, Under Cover of Darkness, Disc 6.
Chapter 31. Gus met his private investigator at Café René. Despite the French name, it was about as continental as French toast and French fries. It was a dive of a joint, with dank walls of exposed red brick and hanging light fixtures that looked like they might drop from the ceiling at any moment. The sagging wood floor was in such disrepair that years of foot traffic had worn paths in the polish. Private booths and bottomless cups of coffee, however, made it Dexter Bryant's favorite meeting place. That, and the fact that they never enforced the rules against cigar smoking. Dex was a former Seattle police officer who had specialized in child abductions and teenage runaways while on the force. As a PI, he was a reputed crackerjack at finding missing persons. To look at him, you'd think he was a missing person. He hadn't shaved since retiring. He'd grown back the ponytail he'd worn as a teenage hippie, before he'd sold out and joined the police force. In his own mind, however, he had never completely sold out. His heart went out to the lost souls he searched for. They took an isolated booth in the back, where Gus gave him the latest. Dex lit up a cigar and listened. He didn't just smoke his cigar, he admired it, checking out the burn as his client talked on. He took a long, slow drag when Gus had finished. Thick gray smoke poured from his lips as he spoke.
"We need to go on the offensive, try to develop some leads. You got media contacts?"
"Sure."
"My advice is to use them."
Gus sipped his coffee, waved away the cloud of smoke.
"I did already. Ended up with a very interesting piece on wife beating on the tube." "Oh, yeah. I saw that. Screw those sneaky reporters, then. Go the advertising route. You can afford it."
"Advertising?"
"Yeah. Just buy a big ad. Put your wife's picture on page 3 of the PI. You know, the space those fancy department stores buy every other week for their once-a-year sale. Offer a reward for information that leads to her return. I'll bet dollars to donuts that'll prompt some calls for me to follow up on."
"Can't hurt.
Here, I brought some samples for format."
He opened his briefcase and spread them across the table. A clump of ash fell from his cigar, which Dex brushed away. Gus thumbed through the samples. Nothing particularly creative, much like the side of the milk cartons he'd never really paid attention to. Dex said,
"I got the template on my computer. We can plug in your wife's picture and information and have it over to the paper in time for tomorrow afternoon's Times, Wednesday morning's PI.
"Shouldn't I run this by the FBI first?"
"What for? So they can run it up their bureaucratic flagpole and come to the same decision we did only 3 weeks later? That's why you hired me, Gus, to do the right thing and to do it right now."
Gus hesitated, then figured what the hell.
"Okay, let's go with it." "Great. I'll need a little advance, of course."
Gus pulled out his checkbook.
"How much?" "Just make it out to the Seattle Times and leave the amount blank. I'll fill in whatever the ad costs. And by the way, while you got the checkbook out..."
Gus looked up suspiciously.
"Now don't go looking at me like that," said Desk. "I told you I was a full-service private investigator. I'm just throwing out ideas. This one's a little off the wall, but I know this psychic."
"A psychic?"
"Yeah. Someone who can hold a piece of jewelry or an article of clothing. Pick up on some vibes or whatever. Maybe help you find your wife. I think it's a little hokey, but some police forces use them, so why shouldn't you?"
If you're serious about pulling out all the stops, that's just an option I want to make available to you. I'll think about that. Let's see where the ads take us first.
Sure. It's your call.
Gus handed over the check, then took a closer look at the sample ads scattered on the table before him. A 17-year-old girl. A boy in kindergarten. A half dozen others. Wives, sons, and daughters. Just a bunch of names and faces on paper. The black and white legacy of families torn apart. Were any of these people ever found? Dex chomped nervously on a cigar.
Yeah, most of them.
How many alive? He answered in a quiet, serious tone.
A few.
Gus leaned back, his expression vague. Dex said,
There's no guarantees in this business, Mr. Wheatley.
You're telling me, Gus said with concern. Andy's meeting lasted till almost five. They walked out together and separated in the hotel lobby. Victoria took a cab back to the airport, promising Isaac she'd probably have some revisions to her profile. Gould headed for the bar, mumbling something about the prospect of finding more of those tasty little goldfish crackers. Isaac walked Andy to her car. Andy enjoyed spending time with Isaac again. Since his promotion to ASAC, she hadn't seen him nearly as often as when he was her direct supervisor. The more they were together, however, the more she realized it wasn't his supervision she missed. It was his company. The rain had cleared, but the pavement was still wet. It was just beyond dusk, and the sun had disappeared without ever really appearing. Andy walked the brightest path to her car, beneath the center line of street lamps. So what's up with Gould? She asked. Isaac buried his hands in his coat pockets, walking at her side.
Like I said, I just wanted another perspective on this.
That sounds like bull.
I know, but it's true.
Gould has more profiling experience than anyone I know outside of Quantico. He's a pain, but I think he helped us focus. I thought maybe you brought him in because you were unhappy with me.
Not at all.
They stopped at Andy's car.
It's Victoria I'm worried about.
Victoria?
She's spread too thin. All the ISU profilers are.
I have to admit, I wasn't all that impressed with the profile she prepared. Not as insightful as I had expected.
You're being kind, Andy. It was pure boilerplate. The usual stuff about serial killers that someone like Victoria can rattle off in her sleep.
So you brought Gould in to help her?
Heck no. I brought Gould in to kick her in the ass.
She's not going to take orders from Gould.
You're missing the point. Gould is the last guy on Earth she wants upstaging her.
You think she wants it getting back to Quantico that it was a retired old fart like Gould, not her, who cracked this case?
You can bet she'll give our case top priority from here on out.
So is Gould on or off the case?
He's off, Isaac said with a chuckle. He's served his purpose. You can rest easy.
I can't say I exactly took a liking to the old guy, but I almost feel a little sorry for him. You used him.
The guy had a ball.
You think he would have been brushing cracker crumbs all over you if he'd thought this was a long-term relationship?
What does that say about me? I brushed them right back.
They laughed as they recalled the moment, both of them leaning against her car. The laughter was over, but their eyes met and held. They were sharing a smile, but it didn't feel like their usual kidding around. This seemed more serious.
What? Said Andy.
Nothing.
Come on, Isaac. What's that look for? What are you thinking?
I don't know.
It's okay. You can tell me.
He chuckled nervously.
Tell you what?
Where do we go from here? It was a wide-open question at an ambiguous moment. It could have roped in anything from, what's my next assignment, to, what are you doing Saturday night? Maybe it was the age difference. Maybe it was just Isaac's sensitivity to his new position of authority. He whiffed. That phone call from Oregon changed the entire complexion of the case. Andy had to refocus. Back to work.
How so?
This is no longer just a matter of providing support and expertise to the local police in their homicide investigations. We got a possible kidnapping across state lines. It's a Category 7. This is our jurisdiction. The FBI is taking the lead.
Does that mean you're reassigning it?
You've done 3 kidnapping cases, counting that first federal bank robbery that turned into a hostage situation. You did a bang-up job on all of them. Why would I reassign?
This is pretty high profile.
Extremely high profile. This could be a career maker.
Wow. I don't know what to say.
You want it or don't you?
Of course I want it.
Then you can have it. Just one condition.
What?
Don't fuck it up. His words seemed harsh, but she understood the message. No matter what their friendship might someday become, she had to make the grade.
You got nothing to worry about.
Gus drove straight home from his meeting. The Magnolia District could be quite dark on a moonless evening, especially near the waterfront estates on the western edge, what little light from the heavens being blocked by the trees. Trees were in abundance, none of them magnolias. Surveyors back in the 19th century had mistaken the madronas for magnolias. One expansive estate after another, dressed with madronas, oaks, elms, huge Douglas firs, cherry hedges galore, even a stand of bamboo. But no magnolias. It was fitting, thought Gus. A magnificent bluff with everything a homeowner could conceivably want, named for the one thing it didn't actually have. The Mercedes slowed as Gus turned into his driveway. He stopped at the iron gate. 2 huge lanterns glowed atop the imposing stone pillars on either side of the drive. The gate was an antique, a true work of art. Only on very close inspection of the elaborately curved design was the letter C discernible, the family initial of the original owners. This particular estate had been in the same family forever. Gus had admired it since he was a kid, thinking it was the most amazing house ever built. He remembered the night he had first shown it to Beth. It looked much the same then as now, at least from this vantage point, right outside the gate. The night was very similar, too, cloudy and cool, with a fine mist in the air. But things between them were beginning to change. Morgan was still in diapers. Gus was an eager young partner at Preston and Coolidge. They were on their way home from dinner, celebrating the fact that Gus had just been elected to the firm's executive committee. Gus was on the right track, the fast track. He took a detour through Magnolia, driving from the restaurant, and stopped right before the gate.
"Why are you stopping?" asked Beth.
Gus glanced toward the estate, then back at Beth.
"We're here."
"Where?"
"Home."
"Whose home?"
"Ours."
She laughed.
"What bank did you rob?"
"You like it?" She gazed across the manicured lawn in the moonlight, toward the huge Tudor-style house on the hill. It looked like something out of a fairy tale, an expensive fairy tale.
"What's not to like?"
"Someday soon I'm going to buy it for you." She smiled, but it wasn't as wide as he'd expected.
"I mean it," said Gus. "I'm going to buy this house."
"I don't doubt that for a minute."
"You don't sound all that sure."
"I'm completely sure." She looked away toward the house again. "It just scares me a little."
"What scares you?"
"You and this job, this new position."
"It's a great opportunity. I'm the youngest lawyer ever elected to the executive committee. I swear I'm going to run this damn law firm. Next step, managing partner. And then I'm going to buy this house."
She looked out the passenger side window.
"Let's go, okay?"
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing."
"No, something's wrong, tell me." She looked at him coolly.
"Have you noticed lately how often you talk about what you are going to do?"
"I'm sharing with you. These are my plans, my dreams."
"It just seems they used to be more about us They are about us.
What? Because you plan to buy me things, that makes it about us?
He nearly groaned. I just took a huge step up at the firm. Can't you be happy about it? Share it with me?
She blinked, lowered her eyes. I'm sorry, you're right. I should be happy for you.
But you're not.
Her eyes were moist, glistening in the flickering light from the lanterns.
Do you ever look back on our days in that one-bedroom apartment and think those were our happiest times together?
It wasn't the apartment that made us happy.
Exactly. So why should I be happy about moving into a house so big my husband has to work 70 hours a week to pay for it? A house so damn big that when you close the front door, you actually hear an echo. It's like a constant reminder of how alone you really are. I don't want that. I don't want to hear the echoes.
The iron gate started to open, rousing Gus from his memories. Carla must have seen him on the security camera and open it from inside the house. The gate was fully extended, inviting him home, but he didn't pull forward. He was still thinking of Beth's words so clear in his memory. His response was just as clear, chiseled in his mind. He had leaned across the console, brushed her cheek, and kissed her. Then he looked her straight in the eye and spoke softly. I promise you, Beth, I will never let that happen. Only now, years later, did it finally occur to him. Yet again, he had been telling her what he was going to do.
Chapter 32.
Half of Andy's brain was still fried from the meeting at the hotel. The other half was swirling from the confusing exchange with Isaac. He had been right to nip things in the bud. Isaac was rising fast in the bureau and didn't need the reputation for hitting on female agents. She considered taking the onus off him and asking him out on a real date. But that wouldn't be fair either. If he was going to be put in the position of dating a subordinate, it should be on his own initiative. Why tempt a friend to go somewhere he didn't really want to go? She picked up a pizza on her way home, flopped on the couch, and caught the tail end of a Sonics basketball game on television. They were winning by 8, but she would have bet her last 2 slices that they'd blow another fourth-quarter lead. The phone rang with less than a minute to play. The score was tied. The bad guys were closing. With the game in the balance, she was tempted to ignore the phone, but she had watched this unhappy ending unfold too many times this season anyway. She rolled from the couch and answered. Good thing. It was the crime lab. Got a read on those fingerprints, he said. She sat up immediately. Which set? The thumb and index finger from the phone. It took a while to isolate something readable. That's just the nature of a public phone. What did you pull up? The buttons were too smudged, but we got a reed and a match from the mouthpiece.
Who is it?
You're going to be surprised. Beth Wheatley. Andy was stunned into silence. She thanked him for the quick work and hung up, confused. Little over an hour ago, she had convinced Isaac and everyone else at the meeting that the killer was a mind control expert who had crawled inside Beth's head, gotten the secret code she and Morgan used to communicate, and dialed the number himself. Now this. She racked her brain, but her theory and the facts were irreconcilable. Fingerprints generally don't lie. Beth had held the phone in her hand. One way or another, she had been there, and then disappeared. Again. Andy phoned Gus with the news that same night. He had scores of questions, none of which she was prepared to answer. She left him frustrated but grateful for the call. She spent most of Tuesday in the office just getting organized. Isaac had told her to make the Wheatley kidnapping, they were calling it a kidnapping, her top priority. Fortunately, most of her 33 other cases were relatively dormant, but she knew that could change at any moment. She got commitments from other agents to cover the ones most likely to blow, which her supervisor approved. Her supervisor was Kent Lundquist, who had taken over as the violent crimes squad supervisor upon Isaac's promotion to the number two position in the office, assistant special agent in charge. Lundquist reported to Isaac, and he rather frequently reminded Andy that she didn't. It wasn't unusual for an agent to appeal a supervisor's decision to the ASAC, but Andy and Isaac's unusually close relationship made Lundquist quite defensive whenever she went over his head. He seemed fearful that Isaac had more confidence in her than him. On technical or procedural matters that required an experienced eye, that wasn't the case. For decisions that drew on interpersonal skills and raw intelligence, his fears were justified. There was no kidnapping squad as such in the office. Like Andy, plenty of other agents in the violent crime squad had relevant experience. Andy met with three other agents assigned to the Wheatley case, briefing them on each of the known homicides, the Wheatley family, the peculiarities behind Beth and her disappearance. By the end of the day, they had carved out specific areas of responsibility. Everyone had plenty to do. Andy's first task, however, was a direct order from Lundquist himself. He had been in his office reading the afternoon edition of the Seattle Times. He had seen the huge ad with Beth's picture and the offer of a reward. "What the hell is this?" he asked. Andy sat across the desk from him, staring at the page. "This is the first I've seen of it." "Damn it, Henning. You can't let the family haul off and do things like this without coordinating through you. Now get control of your case, or you're going to lose it before you get started." "I'll meet with Gus Wheatley tonight." "And another thing," he said, grousing. "Make damn sure Gus Wheatley plans to make good on $250,000. It's his private reward, but I know how these things play out in the press. If he reneges after we make the arrest, it'll reflect badly on the FBI. "I understand your concerns." "You better, because I'll hold you responsible." "I wouldn't have it any other way," she answered, in a tone that made it impossible to tell if she was gung-ho or a smartass. He glared for a moment, then returned to his newspaper, dismissing her. Andy went straight to her car, speaking to no one on the way out. Andy stopped by the Wheatley residence on her way home from work at the height of dinner hour. Gus greeted her at the door and took her to the dining room, where Morgan was slouched in her chair and poking her peas.
"Hi, Morgan," said Andy.
"Hi,"
she said weakly.
"Sorry to interrupt your dinner."
Morgan pushed her plate away.
"It's okay. We're done."
"Done," said Gus. "You've hardly eaten."
"I'm not hungry."
"You have to eat, sweetheart."
"Why?"
"Because if you don't eat, you'll get sick."
"Is Mommy sick?"
Even she had noticed the eating disorder. Just one more indication of just how oblivious Gus had been. "We're not sure how Mommy feels, but Agent Henning is going to help us find out."
"That's what you said yesterday."
Andy said, "We're working very hard. It just takes time."
"How long?"
Her voice had lost its defiant edge. It had even cracked. Gus scooted onto her chair beside her, put his arm around her, and stroked her head. "We're going to keep looking as long as it takes." They both looked at Andy as if seeking a commitment. "That's right," she told them, "as long as it takes." Some of the anxiety faded from Morgan's expression. The little grown-up was more like a kid again, though her heart was clearly aching.
"Dad, can I feed my goldfish now?"
"Sure." She gave Andy a little smile as she rose from the table, then scampered down the hall. "Don't feed them too much," he called out, but she didn't answer. He glanced at Andy and said, "If those fish get any bigger, I'll have the friends of Willie outside my door demanding I set them free." Andy smiled. Gus checked his empty wine glass and said, "Like some Cabernet?"
"Can't, I'm on duty. I'm actually not much of a weeknight drinker anyway."
"Neither am I, normally."
"I understand."
Gus excused himself and retreated to the kitchen for a refill. Alone at the table, she canvassed the opulent surroundings while contemplating how, without insulting him, she could confirm that Gus was good for the reward. The crystal chandelier was undoubtedly Steuben or Baccarat. On the wall opposite Andy was an antique mahogany and glass cabinet that displayed the Wheatley china. The pattern was distracting at first, as no two plates looked alike. Then Andy realized that each plate was a small piece of a larger picture. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. It was as though someone had cut 12 perfect circles from a huge painting, keeping the plates and discarding the rest. It was a spectacular effect, like something out of a museum. That alone could cover a good chunk of the reward.
"Did you see my ad in this afternoon's paper?" Gus asked as he returned to his chair.
"Yes," she said, startled.
"I'm glad you brought that up. I thought you'd be pleased. A $250,000 reward seems a little hefty, don't you think? If it brings Beth back, I can afford it."
"I'm sure you can, but maybe $100,000 would have been enough."
"I'm not looking for the blue light special here. I'm trying to get my wife back."
"I know that, but an overly generous reward can make the bad guys see dollar signs."
"I don't understand."
"That's because you're thinking like a victim. You need to think like a criminal, like a kidnapper. There's been no ransom demand yet, but you could get one any day. Imagine him sitting out there somewhere trying to figure out how much to demand. There's no science to this. Maybe to him $250,000 sounds like a good number. He thinks that's a ton of money. Then he picks up today's newspaper and sees you offering $250,000 as a reward to any Joe Blow off the street. Suddenly his sights are much higher."
"I hadn't thought of that."
"That's why it's so important that you never do anything like this again without calling me first."
It was a little harsher than she'd intended. Gus said,
"You sound ticked off."
"I just want us to communicate better. I know it's your personality to be proactive, but I'd like you to check with me before you do anything. Agreed?"
Gus nodded, but she'd clearly put him on the defensive.
"All right, I can agree to that. So long as the communication flows both ways."
"I've been keeping you informed."
He raised an eyebrow.
"Have you?"
"Yes, as best I can."
"Then tell me what's going on with Beth's fingerprints."
"I told you, we found a match on the phone."
"Thank you, Joe Friday. Now, can you get beyond the facts and tell me what you're thinking?"
"We think they're hers."
"Come on," he said, eyes narrowing. "Don't be cute.
Surely you must have developed some theories as to how they got there."
"Gus, some aspects of an investigation have to remain confidential."
"I promise, I don't work for Newsweek."
"I'm serious. Some things I can't share with anyone, not even the victim's family."
"Ah, yes, I forgot. That's the 11th commandment, isn't it? Or perhaps it's an addendum to the Magna Carta. Oh, no, I remember now. It's just administrative bullshit some law enforcement bureaucrat made up."
Andy nodded, unoffended by his wit.
"Touché."
He sipped his wine, then turned more serious.
"You must be able to understand my need to know."
"Of course I do."
His gaze tightened. It wasn't a stare or even a glare. It was just a long, hard look. "I didn't sleep a wink last night. Up all night after you called. I kept thinking about those prints, wondering how the hell they got there. My first thought was that the worst had happened. Kept thinking he brought her there, forced her to dial, then killed her, too."
Andy couldn't tell him much, but she couldn't let him twist in the wind, either.
"We searched for any signs of a second victim at the site. Nothing beyond Beth's prints."
"Which triggers a number of other not-so-pleasant possibilities."
"Such as?"
"He brought her there to terrorize her. He let her call home, dial up her daughter's line, and punch out their secret message. Just when she thinks maybe he'll set her free, he shows her the other victim hanging in the tree.